shortwave, AM, FM, and the internet. This is PCJ. Yeah! It's now time for the Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Perrone.
Oh, no!
Yes, well, it's now time again for another edition of the International Happy Station Show. It's nice to have you with me for the next 55 minutes, and we have a jam-packed program of music and other things. One of the things that we have coming up a little later on in the show is about a very, very unique hobby. And I always love talking to people that have fascinating hobbies because, you know, what normally can happen is you find out what a hobby is, and then you get interested in it, and then you start doing some research, and then all of a sudden, you're doing the same hobby yourself. Just like with, let's say, DXing or SWLing. That's shortwave listening. Well, we have an interesting hobby today, which we will tell you about a little later on in the show. And also, I know this is the Happy Station Show, and of course the mood should be happy, but there is a little bit of sad news that we will tell you about in just a little bit. But first, let's kick off with a piece of music from Tina Turner, the theme song to the James Bond movie GoldenEye, here on the International Happy Station.
See reflection. Surface and never a shadow on the wind. I feel his breath. Golden eye, I found his weakness. Golden eye, he'll do what I please. Golden eye, no time for sweetness, but a bitter kiss will bring him to his knees. Shadows as a child. You'll never know how it feels to be the one who's left behind. You'll never know the days, the nights, the tears I've cried. But now my time has come. The girls, they gather around him. If I had him, I wouldn't let him out. Golden eye, not lace or leather. Golden chain, take him to the spot. Golden eye, I'll show him forever. It'll take forever to see what I've got. You'll never know the shadows as a child. You'll never know how it feels to get so close and be denied.
GoldenEye, Tina Turner, beginning our program today. Well, as you probably know, or if you're not an SWL, you probably don't know, but last weekend was the last shortwave broadcasts from Radio Sweden after 70 years. The Swedish radio decided to pull the plug on the medium in favor of new media, despite the fact that over 60% of the world still doesn't have access to high-speed internet. Let's name off a few of those regions. Africa, many parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, many parts of Asia. But nevertheless, in their wisdom, they decided to pull the plug anyway. Well, anyway, that was my little bit of, you can say, editorializing on that subject. But I managed to tune in, and there was quite some absolutely fascinating features. We're going to take a listen to one of them right now that was prepared by George Wood, who for many years hosted Sweden Calling DXers. He's still at Radio Sweden working in the newsroom and doing many other activities. This is a little retrospective that he put together looking at the last 70 years of Radio Sweden.
Like many similar stations, our story began as World War II approached. In 1938, Swedish radio turned on a shortwave transmitter to carry programs in Swedish to the world, mostly to maintain contact with Swedes abroad as the international situation worsened. The following year, programs were added in German and English.
Hello, hello. This is Stockholm, Sweden. Good evening, everybody. Every Wednesday and Saturday night, we are going to arrange a special shortwave program as an experiment, primarily for Swedes in foreign countries. Certain parts of the ordinary program shall be composed into a one-hour transmission. The time for this broadcast is 2 o'clock Swedish time, that is 1 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, the nights between Wednesday and Thursday and Saturday and Sunday.
Soon afterwards, Radio Sweden was also on the air to North America.
Hello, America. Hello, America. This is Sweden calling. Sweden calling. Sweden calls America. This week, Sweden calls all housewives. In a previous program in this series, we brought you the voice of Mr. Yurit, Sweden's Minister of Supplies, who told you something about Sweden's supplies and the extent of rationing. And so today, we thought you might be interested in having a practical demonstration of what the average Swedish housewife can buy in the way of foodstuffs.
That story was about the effects of wartime rationing on households here. And over the years, we've tried to cover Sweden for people out in the world. We talked to Dag Hammarskjöld when he was appointed Secretary General of the United Nations in 1953.
Mr. Hammarskjöld, was this appointment as General Secretary of the United Nations a surprise to you?
Yes, indeed. It was a complete surprise. I hadn't heard anything about it for Tuesday night.
In 1969, Prime Minister Olof Palme explained Swedish neutrality for our listeners.
Neutrality doesn't condemn us to be silent. It rather puts an obligation on us to defend the rights of small nations to live. And therefore, when we have said something in international questions, it is very often just concerned the rights of small nations. Therefore, we protested very strongly against the invasion of the Soviet Union in Czechoslovakia. And therefore, we have protested now recently against the American invasion in Cambodia.
There were tragedies, like Palme's murder in 1986.
Sveriges statsminister Olof Palme är död. Han sköts ikväll i centrala Stockholm. You are tuned to Radio Sweden International, broadcasting from Stockholm. Our regular program schedule for broadcast on this frequency at this time is not coming to you because of the assassination Friday night in Stockholm of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme.
The 2004 Asian tsunami killed hundreds of thousands of people in Asia, of course, but it was also the worst disaster ever affecting Swedes.
Around 20,000 Swedes were holidaying in the region when the killer wave struck, the majority of them in Thailand. More than 1,500 Swedes were injured, and today, 543 are listed as dead or missing.
It's a picture of lots of devastation, lots of people are killed, and lots of uncertainty.
The island is destroyed. It was hit by two waves, first on one side.
When the water got away from the shore, revealing the reef.
But there's been good news over the years as well, like our annual coverage of the Nobel Prizes.
Welcome to a special Nobel edition from Radio Sweden. As today's Nobel Day, we're devoting the broadcast to laureates past, laureates present, science, peace, and the future.
Probably the most popular Radio Sweden program over the years was The Saturday Show. It was created by Roger Wallace and Kim Lochran in 1967, the period when pirate radio was breaking down the doors of stodgy European music radio.
The Maharishi is speaking now.
The highest form of meditation, many great chuckles with The Saturday Show.
I must...
And now we're going over to the Army Mess to meet Major General Funny Face Sidney Coulson, who has some tips for tourists, military tourists, that is.
Well, you chaps, here are a few basic tips when visiting a country like Sweden.
Taking advantage of what was then a very strong medium-wave transmitter that easily reached Britain, the full program ran for 90 minutes a week, filled with the latest from a very vital Swedish rock and pop scene, and some sometimes very controversial political sketches.
Some people hate Radio Sweden so intensely that they never miss a single program.
Our other most famous program, if I may say so, was Sweden Calling DXers, which launched in 1948 as a guide for DXers, hobbyists who listen to shortwave radio.
This is the Swedish Broadcasting Service calling DXers of the world. To begin this first weekly survey, here are two advancers about scheduled DX programs to be broadcast tomorrow, Sunday, February 29th, 1948. The first from the Voice of the Andes.
That was a reenactment of the first edition of Sweden Calling DXers. The program was started by Arne Skoog as a means of helping our listeners enjoy their hobby more, which in the long run meant they might listen to us more. I took over from Arne when the program celebrated its 30th anniversary in 1978. 20 years later, on its 50th birthday, I interviewed Arne about his creation.
Well, my idea was to do something for those who really listen to the shortwave. You see, most of the programs produced and broadcast are on the purpose of the broadcaster, not of the listener.
Most of the material in Sweden Calling DXers was directly contributed by mail from the program's listeners, which made it a very early example of interactivity, maybe even social media, as the printed scripts were mailed as a newsletter to everyone who contributed. Sweden Calling DXers was a pioneer in other ways. The newsletters were uploaded to computer bulletin boards and sent off through ham radio packet radio networks. And in September 1994, it became the first radio program from Sweden, and the first in English from Europe, to be available as an audio file on the Internet. In fact, in the very program where we announced this, we also predicted that one day it would be possible to listen to radio programs live over the Internet.
Welcome to Radio Sweden's live election night coverage, and hello again to those of you listening to us over the internet at radiosweden.org.
So on Monday, we'll be FM, satellite, and internet only. But we hope you can join us then for a special conversation with our colleagues from Swedish Radio's digital media department, looking at what the future holds for us in the online world, including our brand new website, which is about to launch.
And that brings us to the end of another program in our Sweden Calls America series. We're nearing the end of this series. So long again from Sweden.
And that was Radio Sweden's George Wood looking back with a retrospective of the broadcast service, which stopped its shortwave broadcasting last weekend.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the International Happy Station. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. And, of course, our website, www.pcjmedia.com. And a little later on in the program, I'll tell you about some of the new and fascinating things at our website. Now time for music. Here's Gordon Lightfoot, If You Could Read My Mind.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost that you can't see. If I could read your mind, love, what the deep thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind any drugstore would sell. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero would be me. But the heroes often fail, and you won't read that book again, because the ending's just too hard to take. Like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way script, and her number two, a movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out in me. But for now, let's be real. I never knew I could act this way, and I've got to say that I just don't. My love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, but the story's always in. And if you read between the lines, you'll know every feeling that we lack. I never knew I could feel this way, and I've got to say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's gone, and I just can't get it back.
Gordon Lightfoot, If You Could Read My Mind, recorded live a few years ago. You're listening to the International Happy Station. Our website is www.pcjmedia.com. And at our website, you can listen to all the past and present editions of the show, as well as the other programs from PCJ Media. A few questions have been coming in asking when the next edition of Media Network Plus will be going to air. And that will be November 27th. So the next edition of Media Network Plus with Paulette McCrory and myself will be November 27th. We've already started working on that show, and it should be quite interesting. Not too long ago, we've had a number of our listeners in the United Kingdom who've been asking to hear of a singer that was very popular in the UK, especially in the late 50s and 1960s, a singer by the name of Guy Mitchell. And can we play something by him? Well, you know, I'm not a big Guy Mitchell fan. There's a couple of songs of his that I like, and this is one of them right now. So going out to all of you, too many to mention, Heartaches by the Numbers, Guy Mitchell on the International Happy Station.
I've got heartaches by the number, a love that I can't win. But the day that I stop counting, that's the day my world will end. Heartache number one was when you left me. I never knew that I could hurt this way. And heartache number two was when you come back again. You came back but never meant to stay. Yes, I've got heartaches by the number, troubles by the score. Every day you love me less, each day I love you more. Yes, I've got heartaches by the number, a love that I can't win. But the day lost your way. Yes, I've got heartaches by the number, troubles by the score. Every day you love me less, each day I love you more. Yes, I've got heartaches by the number, a love that I can't win. But the day that I stop counting, that's the day.
Guy Mitchell and Heartaches by the Numbers. And you can also get in touch with us, by the way, through our Facebook page. Just do a search for PCJ Media and join that group. Or you can also add me as one of your friends. And for those who don't know how to spell my name, and there was a few people out there, it's very easy. It's K-E-I-T-H. Last name is Perron. That's P-E-R-R-R-R. Not three R's, only two R's. O-N, P-E-R-R-O-N. All right, and you can also contact me directly through our website. You'll find show pages for everything else, also a PCJ shop. And if you want to, you're more than welcome to come join the Happy Station Show Friendship Sponsorship Program. Silver is $1, gold is $5, and platinum is $10. And if you are a member, you can receive a discount from any of the items that you find at the PCJ shop. And by the way, just to let you know, the money does go to help with the production of the show and shows that you care. And we have a number of people to thank, which we will do on next week's show. Okay. As I said earlier, I'm always interested in finding out about people's hobbies. Now, with shortwave listening, it was because of a family member, and I was like, oh, what's this? What are you listening to? Radio Moscow? Oh, that's interesting. And I started listening, and, well, the rest is history, as they say. Other hobbies, motorcycles. I love motorcycles, and always did. And it wasn't until I drove a friend of mine's a number of years ago, and I went, well, I think I'm going to get one. And I did. And then I got a second, and then I got a third. So hobbies to me are, like I said, are always very interesting because so many hobbies out there, and you find one and somebody tells you about it and you get interested, and then all of a sudden you find yourself going out and spending the same money on the hobby that they do. Well, this is a funny story, but my next guest is somebody who I've known for a very long time. Now, when I say a long time, I don't mean 20 years. Now, I'm going to be 40 next month. We have known each other. I'm not kidding. Going back to probably when we were, I would guess, 6 or 7 years old. This is how long we've known each other. Now, we're not going to give his real name on the air because he's performing for us today. So we had to come up with a stage name. So his name is Gio Johnny. Yes? Johnny Gio, Gio Johnny. Is it Johnny Gio? Yes, it is Johnny Gio. Johnny Gio. Yes, yes. Sounds like Johnny Quest. But Gio, what is that? That's an unusual last name, you may be saying. Johnny? Well, no, that's not so unusual, but Gio is. What does Gio stand for, you may say to yourself? It stands for geocaching. Now, there's some of you out there that know what this hobby is, because not too long ago, via our Facebook page, a few of you wrote in saying we should do something about it. Well, lo and behold, this friend of mine, that we go back many, many years, is a geocacher. Can I say that? A geocacher. Well, he's into geocaching. Anyway, to find out more about it, I decided to contact him and ask the age-old question. If it is an age-old question, what exactly is geocaching? Here's Johnny Gio.
Geocaching is a type of high-tech treasure hunting using the global positioning system. So you've probably heard the term GPS, like a lot of people, right?
Right.
So the GPS, it's a constellation of the 27 satellites around the world, and we end up using that system and a GPS receiver that ends up getting a location, exact location on the Earth. And what people are doing now since about May 2000 is hiding and seeking containers called geocaches.
And what's exactly inside the container?
So in this little tiny container is a logbook to say that you found the geocache. So it's a logbook that once you find this hidden cache, you say, yeah, it took me 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And there's a couple trade items in there, small little trade items could be, if kids are finding these as well. I mean, this is all ages trying to find these geocaches, but there's trade items like could be hockey cards or types of sports cards, coins. That type of stuff.
But when did it all begin? What happened? One day somebody woke up and said, we're going to have this like treasure hunt thing. I mean, was there like one person or one group that decided to do this?
Yeah, you know what? It's kind of interesting. Back in about May 1st, 2000, Bill Clinton took off something called Select Availability off the GPS. So what had happened right from that point on May 1st, 2000 is civilians can use the military global positioning system. So basically, in a nutshell, we're playing a game of hiding seeking Tupperware containers with billion-dollar technology, right? So a couple days later, about May 3rd, a guy named Dave Ulmer, and he's from a beautiful little spot. I've had the opportunity to go there, Bend or in Oregon in the United States. He decided, I bet I can make a game out of this. So what he did is he took a nice big bucket, he hid it out in the woods, he marked a coordinate with it. So he took his GPS system, now that civilians can use GPS, he took his GPS and marked a set of coordinates. And what the coordinates are is an exact location of where that bucket was with the GPS receiver. He goes online and says, I want to see if somebody can find this container in the middle of absolute nowhere. with a set of coordinates. And if you do, you can, you know, there's stuff in the bucket you can trade or take or whichever. And a couple of days later, a guy did. I believe the guy's name was Mike, Mike Teal, I believe it is, or Mike Teague. And he went out and found this. And that was the start of geocaching right from there.
You know, I'm thinking right now, I could just imagine it, you know, some people in the Pentagon or some government somewhere is just sitting back saying, wait a second, we're spending how many millions here? And like you said, people are putting things in Tupperware and hiding them behind trees or in a garbage dump somewhere. Did this ever raise any questions?
No, I mean, because it's out there now. It doesn't cost any more money for a military government. I mean, the government that supplies these satellites, I mean, they're there anyways. Civilians are using them for so many things right now. And I'll give you some examples. So right now, trucking companies, to monitor trucking companies, where's the truck as it travels to and from whatever country or countries or provinces or states or wherever. So civilians are using it right now, same as aircraft. I mean, you look at private aircrafts or the aircraft industry, they're using GPS, they're non-military. So it's really, and I've seen, you know, I've been geocaching for about, oh God, it must be, it's a little over 5 years now, you know, in the sport, the hobby's been out for about 10 years. I can't believe how many people have jumped into geocaching now. It's amazing. It truly is. You know, and Keith, I hope you don't mind if I give some stats here.
No, go right ahead.
Yeah, so we're looking at about a little over 1,200,000 geocaches worldwide. You know, here in Edmonton alone, there's probably, you know, 1,000 or so caches in around the area right now. There's just so many geocaches out there. Over 220 countries are into geocaching now. I mean, that's ballooned and skyrocketed. Even these iPhones, do you have iPhones out there as well?
Yes, I do. Know. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I ask that, you know, I laugh because it might be called something different, or I don't want to just assume the same as BlackBerry here. So the iPhones now have an application for geocaching. You can actually buy the application.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
So if somebody wants to, say, hide one of these, I mean, for example, can I just, let's say, go to my kitchen, get a piece of Tupperware, put something inside, and then find out what the coordinates are of where I'm hiding it, post it somewhere, and that's it?
Yes, that is it. All you'd have to do, if you have a GPS receiver, that's all you would have to do is you just grab your a type of waterproof container. Put a little logbook and some trade items. You don't have to put trade items, but I mean, it's always fun for other people when they like to trade things. And you go to somewhere, let's say out in the middle of a beautiful little location near waterfalls or a nice set of stairs down in the woods or just a beautiful spot. And that's what geocaching is to me. It takes you to a place that a tour guide may not have taken you. You know, that's how you got to think of it. Beautiful locations. You hide a little container and now, you hide that container, you take your GPS, you mark a coordinate, a waypoint, and that's a set, you know, the coordinates, set of numbers of a specific spot on our Earth. You go back to the website, so then you start off as a new member, so you just have to log on for the first time and create a free account, so it's free to do this. And you go on and mark the coordinates and say, I hid this geocache, call the little name of some kind, like, and go from there. And you'll have people, what they call, they want to be the first to find on these geocaches. And it's almost, it's a huge competition. People want to be the first person to ever find your geocache.
Do they have the kind of competitions where, let's say, money's involved? I mean, there could be maybe like, say, 25 in a specific area.
Okay.
And the one that finds all 25 first wins like a prize of, let's say, $100 or something.
No, they don't have that. They don't have that, but something very similar to that. So in a geocache, you can have a first-to-find prize. So that could be a nice gift certificate to a restaurant or something like that. People are doing that. I've done that a couple times where I've done a nice first-to-find, a little gift of some kind. It doesn't have to be very much, nothing too monetary, a nice flashlight or something along that lines.
So the people that are doing this, I mean, how would you classify them? Are they just like, this is just like a hobby like any other hobby, or is it a special kind of person?
I'm seeing more and more. At first, I thought it was the person that's really good with computers and technology. I thought it may be a person with an outdoor adventure, because you're using both. You're using, you know, I'm good with a computer. Let's say I'm also the outdoors type, so it's a combination of the both. I'm seeing more and more people, you know, of all different genres and get into this hobby, and it's so nice to see. It absolutely is. You see so many people are getting into this hobby, so it's great. Yeah.
There's been some controversy over geocaching now in a number of countries. Some countries have tried to ban it outright because of the stupid activity of other people.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is putting geocaches in areas that are unsafe, like what we were just talking about a moment ago before we recorded this, near electrical power lines and such.
Yes, exactly. That's such a dangerous thing to do, putting other people and themselves in jeopardy by taking a hidden container and tucking away, let's say, here's an example, in an energized pedestal of a street light. So they, you know, the door may be open or a cover missing, and they just tuck this electrical the geocaches in electrical equipment, and that scares me, because our hobby's about going out in the wilderness, having fun, spending time with family. You know, your kids are doing it. You don't want to put that danger. Why introduce the hazard of electricity in such a fun hobby? And so I have a blog talking about it, promoting it.
Have you seen these kind of things in the past?
Absolutely, I have. Yeah, no question about it. I've seen a lot of different geocaches, magnetic geocaches on sides of equipment, on the side of power bases, in street lamps. And what I do, and here's, you know, if somebody ever comes across this, so if the listeners right now, if they ever decide to try geocaching and they come across this type of situation, I suggest that all they do is just simply contact the geocache owner, the owner of the geocache, and just say a friendly FYI, to say, I believe you should be remove this because of a certain hazard. Here, you know, maybe even use my link for reference, but just talk about the dangers of electricity. And if they're not responsive to it, I suggest going to the person who approved the cache. And the way to do that, on every geocache listing, at the bottom is the approver's contact information. So you can always contact the approver of the geocache, a volunteer from geocaching.com, and they will remove something dangerous. So that's the electrical side of it. Keith, you were referencing other types of dangerous geocaches, and some are, here's some examples, geocaches on railroad tracks, or geocaches on imminent danger on a side of a very, very dangerous cliff, and there's no warning that children shouldn't do it, let's say. You can report those as well.
You know, when I was reading up about this, I came across some funny facts, and these are things that you probably have heard before, but there are some countries that want to ban geocaching because they're afraid that spies, people that work for secret services and intelligence agencies, will use it for dead drops. Have you heard this before?
I have not. No.
No?
Not whatsoever.
No. Apparently, in Pakistan and in China, they are trying to ban it. Mm-hmm. Because they're afraid that intelligence agencies will use this to pass along information to their agents.
Wow. All right, well, that's news to me. Yeah, for sure. Definitely news to me. I've never heard that. The only thing I've heard security-wise, and you can read this online on any kind of electronic newspaper, is people hiding geocaches on the side of bridges. And, of course, people come up and think, well, what is that? What is that black box on the side of a bridge? You know, is it a bomb? And that's why you can't hide them on military bases. That's prohibited as well, because what is that container that's left out in the open? So there's a little bit of, there's places where you shouldn't and cannot hide those geocaches.
But there was something that happened to you when you were in Scotland. Right?
Yeah, there is. So... one thing, you know, and I'll go into one of the most beautiful things about geocaches is, again, you know, 200 plus countries across our world that that you can play this game in. And I'm very fortunate that I've cashed from here in Canada, United States, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, in France, spent time in France, and geocached through there, Mexico. I'm glad you mentioned this one. So here's myself, my wife, we're up geocaching way up in the top of the highlands of Scotland. And there's one called, I believe it was Knocknabba, that's the name of the geocache, and beautiful little trail. So decided, well, you know, I'm going to take, Lisa, you just, you know, you wait here in the car, and I'm going to walk up the trail to find this geocache. So I walk along the trail, it's about a kilometer, and I'm walking through about, it seems like 16,000 sheep. Make my way, and there's a beautiful little bridge and a creek. I'm thinking, oh, this is fantastic. And I'm at one with nature, and I'm feeling relaxed and peaceful. And I look under the one side of the bridge, and I see the suitcase. And I'm thinking, oh, that must be the geocache. So I go up the container. I open it up. There's two big batteries, wiring, and some electronic device. Well, I'm thinking this thing's a bomb. I run for about 400 meters. I probably screamed like a small girl, and that's fine. I mean, so I find out after the fact what that container was a pedometer to tell you how many people were going across that little bridge on this trail. The geocache was on the other side of the bridge, and I wasn't aware of it. But I mean, if they would have maybe mentioned that in the listing, let's say, that would have helped quite a bit. But yeah, that was a kind of a scary situation. You know, I still laugh about it now. That was about a couple of years ago that happened.
Where are some of the strangest places that people put these?
Oh, strange. You know, we have, there's caches right downtown, a lot of like the busiest spot, right on, a street corner, some of the busiest street corners, tucked up underneath a mailbox or in a bus stop. And you have to be so careful that no one sees you grab these tiny little geocaches. Now, one thing I didn't explain, there's cache containers can look like a Tupperware box or an ammo box, but they can be also very tiny. They can be a what we call micros. They can be in a type of the old film containers, those plastic film containers,
right?
Cameras. They can be even smaller than that, called nanos, tiny containers, almost the size of a cover to a valve stem of your tire, that tiny. With a little tiny logbook, you have to, you know, put your name, your initials at least in that, and to say that you found the cache. And they tuck them up just about everywhere. So I've seen that. Another one, I won't say strange, but difficult, is here the drive-thrus to coffee shops. They'll put them right tucked up underneath the counter. So as you drive up to get a coffee at a drive-thru coffee place, you have to reach under their little counter thing at the window, pull this thing out, and document your name and while you're grabbing your coffee. So, you know, those are some examples.
Have you ever had people look at you strangely? Like, they have no idea what you're doing. They're looking at you, and you have your hand in somewhere. You pull out a little container, then you're writing something, then you put it back in. Have people looked at you strangely, and you look back at them, and they just kind of like pretend they didn't see?
Absolutely. Just about every time I geocache. So you're out somewhere, and you're a little park. You're at a beautiful little park, and there's people are kind of looking, wondering, why is that man standing beside that tree looking around, you know? And I'm pretending I'm someone taking care of trees, like I'm a tree trimmer or something. I should just get a vest. But, you know, there's little tricks to the trade. So I grab my, you know, a GPS receiver. It can, you know, you can make it pretend it's a phone. I've done that a number of times where I just kind of pretend I'm having a conversation on a phone when it's actually my GPS receiver. And, you know, I'm talking away to myself and just looking at the tree, at the beautiful bark, and, you know, there's a cache hanging in the tree, and people don't realize that. So there's ways, there's stealth ways how to log your finds.
If somebody's interested in getting into this hobby,
yes,
what are the first things they need to do and the first things they need to know?
Well, right off the bat, if you want more information, go on to their website. It's www.geocaching, so that's geocaching.com. You go onto the website, go onto a tab, I believe it's called Get Started, and just read up on it. Read on this information. and it'll tell you all about the fun hobby of geocaching, getting out there in the wilderness, finding containers, hiding and seeking containers. Also, I suggest you definitely need to have a GPS. You can borrow one from a friend if you want to try. Just borrow a GPS. Get familiar how to mark coordinates with it. And again, the coordinates are specific numbers on our grid of the Earth of where you are and located. And it's pretty easy to get into. Again, I got into it so easily, and I truly enjoy the hobby. Again, it's taken me to beautiful places across our globe.
Are there international competitions where, say, the wealthy do, you know, get on planes and fly to another country and then fly to another country? Does that kind of thing exist?
Actually, I won't go to it. It's not to that point, but I would say it's pretty close to that. People do travel specifically just to geocache. I have friends here in Canada, actually here in Edmonton, that will travel somewhere to Peru just to find a geocache that no one else has found. And he just travels to do that. Yes, well, absolutely. So, and for myself, I've traveled to a different country with a group of guys. There was four of us, and we traveled down to the United States here from Canada just to geocache in Washington State have such a fun time doing that. You know, we spent a weekend just geocaching, but finding about 50 different geocaches just for a fun weekend trip.
You know, a moment ago we were talking about some of the dumb places that people put these things.
Yeah.
What about, for example, when it comes to environment? Because let's say if you have a very large park, it is a very good place to hide something. But yet, yeah, if you're going to have, let's say, a few hundred people running through a park trying to find something in a park, that could cause a considerable amount of damage. Now, in Canada, the parks actually, I don't remember what, I think you said they tried to ban it or they did ban it?
They did, actually. It was an environmental issue where people, you know, the Parks Canada were very concerned with people going in off trails, off pathways, and crushing brand new vegetation, beautiful little trees and bushes and moss. And so what they did, they banned geocaching from our parks, which is which I understand. I really do. Being somewhat an environmentalist myself, that is concerning. So what they've done is they brought it back, but there's restrictions. So now you have to apply and pretty well show, you know, pretty well a case plan of where your geocache is, how it's close to a pathway, like right beside a pathway, a roadway where you don't have to crush vegetation. And I think that's fantastic. So now you're not creating all these brand new paths, hurting vegetation. And another thing about geocaching, there's a second part to that. We call it CITO. So it's cash in, trash out. And geocachers worldwide have events where we clean up parks. So we meet at a set of coordinates at a park on a specific day. And this is, we can do it throughout the year, but there's sometimes a specific date every year that the geocaching.com kind of publicizes this, but it can be throughout the year as well. And you meet at a specific spot and you get together with your friends, your fellow geocaching friends from the town or city, and you clean up a park. You get a bunch of bags, and sometimes here in Edmonton, we work with the city of Edmonton, and they supply the bags and the pickup service of all the garbage bags. And we go clean a park, all the garbage around a river, and we pick up 20, 30 bags of garbage sometimes in around a whole area, you know, where people are dumping stuff. So it kind of gives back to the community as well, and that's worldwide. CITO happens worldwide.
John, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you want more information, check out our website. I'll give out the URL later on, because at our website you'll find John's blog as well as the website for geocaching itself. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
And I was speaking there with my old friend, Johnny Geo. If you want to find out more information about geocaching, go to our website and look for this show, and you'll have links there. So if you want to get interested in the hobby and read Johnny Geo's blog, go to www.pcjmedia.com. Now time for one more piece of music before we end off. An old favorite here on the show, Bert Klemfert and the Prague Polka on the International Happy Station. A favourite here on the show, Bert Klemfurt and the Prague Polka here on the International Happy Station. Well, that's it. That's all we have time for. Once again, our email address is our website, www.pcjmedia.com. And our email address, and I think I'll get it right this time. I will get it right. pcjmedia@gmail.com. So on behalf of our production assistant, Johan Becker, our technician Kevin Lee, this is Keith Perron saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.